Welcome to the next in our series of our virtual fireside chats. I'm Tracy Lake. I'm a partner in the energy and utilities team at Waitmans, national law firm. If you've seen any of the other fireside chats that we've been doing, you'll know that we've been talking to a number of people, very knowledgeable people within the energy industry, on a range of matters and including, where applicable, how businesses might have been impacted by COVID-19. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Craig Dyke, who is the Regulation and Strategy Manager for National Grid Electricity System Operator. Craig, welcome, and thanks for your time today. Really grateful. So first of all, if you've got some chance just to introduce yourself really and explain the roles that you've undertaken at National Grid.
Yeah, so I guess it goes back to, so I started in the industry and National Grid actually back in March 2000. So I came into the business as a power system engineer working around our control centre down in Berkshire. And that was about making sure that the control room had the right tools and services, understood what the plan was. So the fact it was creating a plan and the control room, then they would go off and deliver it. I then moved up to the Midlands, sort of late 2002, early 2003, started a little bit more long-term planning, but then moved from there into commercial environment. So then undertook a role which was all about developing and procuring services that we use as electricity system operator to balance the system. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by balancing the system as we go into what ESO actually do. I then moved from that sort of commercial role into a strategy role, where I was working on, so what was our long-term strategy around development of smart grids and smart meters. And then sort of a bit of a turn then in my career, went from electricity side of the business to gas. So in the gas side of the business for 5 years. And that was leading on the network development processes, all the connection contracts into the national transmission system for gas. Then came back into electricity probably about 18 months ago now, undertaking a couple of roles. So most recently head of networks last year, where I led on the investigation into the 9th of August power cut, which I'm sure a lot of you sort of listening will sort of remember. And then more recently moved into the head of strategy and regulation role. My role today, what it's about is looking at that long-term where energy is going to go, setting up where we think energy policy needs to go and what direction it will take the net zero by 2050, but also taking that intelligence as well and driving where we think we want to go as a business. So as much as you're looking externally, it drives our position internally as well. And the regulation side as well. So I own that strategic relationship with Ofgem, so with the regulator. So that's about ensuring that we have a really good relationship. They understand what we're saying and they trust what we're saying as well. And that relationship is really, really important. And it's become even more important the last few months into the current situation.
That's great. It's really useful background. And I think what I take from what you've just said, and as I know, National Grid has sort of many facets to what it does day to day to keep our energy flowing. But particularly today, we're going to talk more about the role of National Grid as ESO, as electricity system operator. So can you explain more about exactly what that is and what National Grid does to play that role?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the NASCAR, so electricity system operator, and I'll use the terminology ESO because it's less of a mouthful than spelling out the five words. So 1st of April 2019 last year, so ESO, we became legally separate. And that's from the rest of us. And what that means was before that point in time, the electricity transmission owner business, i.e. people own the assets, and as a system operator, we were a single legal entity. Now that move was made last year, and that was to give us more independence and to demonstrate that we were pushing the boundaries of what the art of the possible was with regards to future network development. And it's important, I guess, for us to get across that. So for us, we don't own the electricity or the energy that flows across our networks. We don't actually own the network. So effectively, people refer to sometimes as the logistics guys. Yeah. So we get the power from where it comes on the system to where it comes off. We make sure it's there when we need it. So when you switch that light on or you switch your iPad on, it's there ready for you. But we also make sure as well, and this is the bit that doesn't always get taken account, but it's the quality you need as well. So all of the devices we have in our homes, industrial and commercial assets, they're all driven and designed to a certain technical specification. So we have to make sure the electricity that comes onto the network is of the good quality. When it leaves the network, is of the same quality. So when it comes down to us as consumers, we can actually use it to the best of our ability to work all the appliances we've got all around us today. So, mm-hmm. So for us, we've got logistics and transporting those large amounts of energy and it's making sure that everything, so supply and demand, are balanced second by second.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting for people, because I think, you know, as we do with a lot of things, people take for granted that, as you know, you flick a switch, you go to make a cup of tea, the energy is there for you to do that, but don't necessarily understand what it takes to manage that supply and demand. And that's exactly the role that National Grid plays. So yeah, thank you for that that explanation. So I suppose what I would say though is National Grid is obviously one of, and a big part of, that energy industry, but clearly you will collaborate and work with other industry participants and stakeholders. So can you explain to us how National Grid does that in order to fulfill its role as ESO?
Yeah, so I mean, the obvious are the people we have to work with. So we have to work with the network. So the three big transmission owners, so National Grid, Scottish Power, and Scottish Hydro. So we have to work very closely with them, because clearly we are operating their networks on their behalf. But clearly we then also have to work with distribution networks as well. So clearly the next layer of voltage down of the transmission network is a distribution network. So, and that's born through history. And fundamentally, when you break it down, as much as there are different networks and different level of owners, you could argue there's only one wire, and that therefore there is only one, and it brings it this whole system thing. And people talk around whole systems as a future thing, i.e. integration of transport, aviation, heat and energy, but actually the whole system's always been there. It's just we've never actually labeled it as anything. We've always taken it for granted. So a lot of the work we do about how we provide access to the system for the transmission networks, and also making sure that the electricity we pass on the distribution is good quality supply, is driven by a lot of the codes and the frameworks we have in place. And that drives a lot of the rules and regulations and the obligations it puts on us and the rest of the network. And that's the obvious stuff. But we also do a lot of collaboration outside of the obvious networks as well. So some good examples more recently where we've been doing a lot of work with Renewable UK. Clearly the amount of wind on the system today is far greater than it was 10, 20 years ago. And as the wind farms start to connect, we recognize that the codes and frameworks and the systems just weren't fit for purpose. So we've been doing a lot of work about how we can integrate the systems and signals from the wind farms, whether offshore and onshore, into the control rooms, which means for the control room, they get better information so they can make decisions. But also it means that the new renewable generation can also participate in markets, therefore seek additional revenues as well. So that's a big turning point for us. And for us, this is not just about wind. What we've done today for the, I think it's 90 wind farms, we can build on that. And therefore, when solar starts to come along in the markets, that platform is there. And therefore, it will allow solar to actually participate in those markets.
Yeah, that's quite right, isn't it? It's looking to the future. And we'll come on later to a bit of a discussion around heading towards that future with net zero. So is there anything at the moment, any projects that you're working on with partners to help us towards that, to deliver that net zero?
Yeah, so when we've just sort of kicked off in the last month or two, actually, and it would have been on our Twitter feed, it's called a 4D Heat Project. And that's an innovation project which we're working on in Scotland with a company called Delta E, Everose and Passive Systems. And that's looking at, so Scotland's got a lot of wind. It's got a load of wind farms in Scotland, and we know that. And we also know that actually there are times where there isn't the capacity to get all of the wind out of Scotland. Therefore, our role is to actually constrain some of the wind. And you'll see a lot of the headlines in the press for what that means and what that looks like and what it costs. We are looking at ways of recognizing in Scotland, a lot of people are off gas with regards to heating their homes. So they're on electricity storage systems. And we are looking at a way through this innovation project, working out where there is that excess wind, how can we marry that excess wind up to this electric storage heating, such that actually rather than just curtailing the wind, that energy is actually transferred across, and therefore those people are off grid are getting the benefit from it. And it's also in areas as well, which you could argue would welcome it from an economy perspective as well. So that's a big project we're looking at. So the Renewable UK is like really specific around a specific wind farm. This is looking much broader, and looking at societal impact as well. So we're looking at small innovation, but also the big innovative stuff as well. And again, working with Scottish Government, fitting in with their future energy strategy. So this is a really good position for us to be in.
That sounds really interesting, actually. And it's I think it's great that now, you know, getting involved in all those renewable projects. And I think people genuinely are more interested these days in where their energy is coming from. So it's great to hear about projects like that. Turning now to the topic of the moment, although I think we all hope this moment wouldn't quite go on for so long. Yeah. That's the topic that is COVID-19. So People might not generally think that the virus would affect a business like National Grid, thinking more about affecting retail and consumers. But what impact has COVID had on the electricity system? And knowing, as I do, that National Grid is, as paramount, it has safety and reliability at heart. What have you had to do as ESO to maintain that safe and reliable system?
So the first one wouldn't be so obvious to the public. So, and I'll talk about some of the stuff that would have been in the media and the public domain. But the first thing we did before we went to lockdown, we just completely changed our ways of working around our two control rooms, because we recognised we had to protect those individuals from a not just COVID-19, but a wellbeing perspective, and also protect their family as well. So the first thing we did was to make sure we brought in a completely different way of working for our two control rooms. Whereas normally, for a good example, we'd normally share resource across the two control rooms, and we would just use we completely locked that down straight away. So we ran, and we are today running those two control rooms separately. We then put in a lot of protections and controls around that, which meant that we were able to keep our absentee rates down really, really, really low. Which means that where other businesses are having to move to different sort of shift patterns, we managed to keep that down and actually protect our control room staff. And that's the stuff that just you just wouldn't come out. But that was our first thing, making sure we protected our people.
Yeah.
Where we went to then was recognizing, okay, we're going into the summer now. What does that actually mean for system operation? Now, you'd always expect the electricity demand in summer to be lower than it would be in the winter, just checking because you don't need heating on and clearly there's no lightning load. But then when you roll into that lockdown and the different ways of working regards businesses and industrial and commercial loads dropping down, that meant for us there was a massive drop off in demand. And we're talking in the order of over 20% of drop in demand on average. And that's a big, big challenge for us. Because I think a lot of people think that the more demand you have, the more challenges for system operation. But that's not the case. The more demand you have, generally, the more options you have to actually manage some of it. If we have less demand, what that generally means is the market then reacts, such as actually it won't run certain generation you would want. So we had to step back and work out how we were actually going to get through the summer, what were the tools we were going to need in order to manage those low demand periods. We then took three sort of actions around that. The first was recognizing that we went right back to the basics of the frameworks and the codes. And it's interesting where everyone thinks they understand what the codes mean. But when you actually look to how you're going to use them in anger, you go, oh yeah, that's quite ambiguous. So we put a grid code change in, an emergency grid code change, which meant we actually changed the grid code in the space of a week. And for anyone who's been in any grid code change, you know you're lucky if you get a change within a year. So we managed to get it through in a week, which was a great, great effort. The second one we did as well, we put in place a contract with EDF, which would have been in the media, around reducing the output of Sizewell power station. And the reason we did that, because the nuclear power station will run at full load. And what we wanted power stations running at part load. So you can think of it as a way where you're driving your car, but you're going as fast as you can, but you've got nowhere else to go. You can't get any quicker. Yeah. So what that means for us is almost taking like a big car off the network, but replace it with smaller cars that aren't operating at full load. That means when you need that extra power, you can accelerate those cars to bring the frequency back up to speed. So that was the reason why what we did with Sizewell power station. And the third thing we did, which we're really proud of, and you'll be familiar with this, Tracy, is that we developed a brand new service in the space of 10 days from scratch. And that's terms and conditions, consulting on it, engage with stakeholders. And that's creating a brand new market and actually getting up to over 3 gigawatts of participants in the space of 10 days. And that's a massive achievement. A third of that was solar as well. Never had solar as a participant before in any market. So that was a massive achievement. But then beyond that, and almost goes back to what we said at the start around collaboration, recognizing this, all of this new market participants was at the distribution level. If we started to enact some of those services, it would impact the distribution network. So we had to collaborate really, really closely with all 9 DNOs to make sure that they understood where the market participants were, and they were able to feed into the process as well. So they understood when we took an action, they were ready for it. So they were three big things we've had to undertake that actually gets us through sort of the summer period.
No, that's great. And it's it is something to be proud of, isn't it? And as you say, I know from experience that it's not usual that you get things through that quickly. So that just shows how working collaboratively can help, doesn't it? And it's fantastic that you've been able to do that. And it was interesting reading in the press about the record-breaking periods that we've had of coal-free electricity generation. So what parts might COVID have had in that, do you think? And will there be other aspects such as the weather that will have affected that as well?
Yeah, so that's a good input. And it's a good question, because this it's easy to relate everything back to COVID-19 and therefore, I mean, midnight tonight you would have seen, I think we were on the BBC News last night and there'd be stuff in the press this morning. So we've now gone 2 months, it's coal free. Yeah. Good question, would that have happened anyway? Maybe, maybe not. And what else have we seen? We've also seen sort of record low demand, record low carbon intensity. We've seen solar on certain days being the highest sort of generator output, which you never would have said 5-10 years ago. But I think what COVID-19's done, I guess, from that perspective, it's done sort of two things. Yes, one is sort of lowered the demand.
Yeah.
So as a result of that, as I sort of said, the market needs to actually put less generation on. And clearly, you're always going to build up with your sort of hydro and solar, wind, and then gas, and then coal will be the last on. So coal is so far out of merit. It's never going to run unless we probably run it for system security reasons. And what we foresee is no need for that. But what you also see as well, as a result of COVID-19, and you'll see this with some of the smart tariffs out there for the likes of Octopus, you'll see where those lower demand periods are over the weekend. It's actually really suppressing the wholesale price, such that actually it's turning negative, which means people like us, we will get encouraged to use electricity and actually get paid to charge electric vehicles. Now, this sort of happened sometime last year over patches, but actually seems to be happening most weekends these days, which is a massive shift from where we were before.
Time to get an electric vehicle then, I think.
It is. Yeah. To get one built on time.
Well, that's it, isn't it now? So, no, that's all really, really interesting, Craig. Thanks. And something that we just touched on earlier around energy efficiency, and I'm always interested in hearing what the man in the street thinks of things. So I think there's far more information now available about climate change impacts on the environment. Do you see that people are genuinely more interested about that now? And do you see any trends at National Grid as to how that's going?
Yeah, so we see that through the electricity demand, and that's not just the total demand through the year, but also those peak demands through the winter as well. And we've always talked around the fact it's okay to decarbonize the electricity market and then you move into actually electrifying things. But actually the thing that's always consistent where you want to go first is the efficiency bit. And that is probably the biggest thing we've seen with regards driving down peak demands on the system. So if you went back 10, 15 years, you might have been talking around a peak electricity demand in the winter of in the order of 60 to 65 gigawatts as a ballpark. And that is mainly made up of heating load, lighting load, and cooking load, where we're all getting home in winter and evening, 5 o'clock, turn the lights on, heating, cooking. What we see now, that peak demand for electricity is in the order of just around 50 gigawatts, which is a sort of 10 gigawatt drop across probably a 10 to 15 year period. And a lot of that is driven by energy efficiency. And that's changing the light bulbs out from the incandescent to LEDs, but also just more efficient appliances, not just in the home, but in the industrial and commercial loads as well. And that's been driven in the main by that. It's a big cost factor. And it's, I guess if you can get your processes down, get your electricity bills down, and make your processes much more effective. And that's what we've actually seen. One thing we've developed, and we kicked it around, is a website first of all. Now it's an app which is out there for people to use. We have what's known as the ESO carbon intensity app, and it will show you on a half hour by half hour basis the carbon intensity of electricity across all the geographic regions of the UK. It's really, really easy to use. Even I can use it occasionally. But what it allows people to do is you can actually take people and companies actually taking that data, putting it into their own systems, and then determining when they want to use electricity as well, because they want to use it when it's greenest, which also means it's probably the cheapest time as well. Yeah. So it's having two benefits, having an economic benefit, it's also having a green benefit as well.
Yeah, of course. And I suppose it's not only consumers like you or I doing that, it will be a business doing that as well. So as well as looking at you know, solar panels and all the other things that they can do to reduce costs and take more of an efficient use of energy, they'll be looking at all of those things as well. So no, it's heading in the right direction, isn't it? And I know that National Grid has got a target of being able to operate the electricity system with zero carbon sources by 2025. So we say that as a statement and we've read about it, but what actually does that mean? What are you having to do to get the system ready for that?
Yeah, so what that actually means is if even if you took today's network, then okay, you've got solar on, you've got wind on, you've got interconnectors, you've got hydro, and but you probably have some gas running as well. Hmm. And what that effectively means is that electricity is electricity, so it doesn't matter what the source is, it's fundamental electricity, so it is always the same. But traditionally, what that means is that your gas-fired power stations, your coal, and what would have been oil going back 10 or 20 years ago, they are big, literally big rotating lumps of copper on the network. And actually, what that means for the network is it actually transposes like an energy effect on the network. So it actually gives the network energy. And what that means is when a generator then falls off because it's coming off maintenance or it trips off, the frequency actually stays relatively stable because that energy within the network is still there because it's being provided by those big rotating lumps of copper. As we move into a world whereby you see less of that in the network, so as we've talked about, there's no coal, there's less gas, it's being driven by a power electronic source, so from solar and from wind. Now that doesn't provide the same level of energy into the network as you would typically get. So what we're saying is if the network in 2025 will offer us the opportunity such that it will just be solar, wind, there will be no gas on the network, that will be quite a challenge for us, because it would also be quite expensive. So we could do it today, but it would cost so much money. Yeah. Therefore, we need a plan, and we have a plan to get to 2025, such when the market determines that there's no sort of rotating plant running today, we will have the services and tools that we can operate that market. So we're looking at things such as creating new markets, so attracting new players are going to help us, and also working with technology providers as well. So for example, wind farms, we believe they've got the capability to do it, but it's about trialing and testing some of that. So when we get to 2025, we're ready to go.
Yeah, as you say, a lot of trial and testing, a lot of planning, and again, that collaborative working with other partners. And that's what you always do well, I think. So, you know, we could talk, I think, for a whole day on all sorts of aspects of this, Craig. But I think we've probably reached the stage now where, without getting too technical, we've probably answered the questions that most people would want to ask you. So really grateful for your time today. Thank you very much. We'll speak again soon, no doubt.
Okay. Thank you, Tracy.
Cheers, Craig. Bye.
See you later. Bye.